Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Inside Indy Sports Podcast. I'm Tyler James, and I'm joined once again by the one and only Eric Hansen. Together, we cover Notre Dame football, recruiting, and more for InsideIndySports.com on the Rivals Network. The blue-gold game is in the books. A fairly entertaining scrimmage wrapped up Notre Dame's spring football and will send us into the summer with plenty of reasons for optimism and questions to ponder. And who better to ponder with than our pal Bob Morton, a former Notre Dame offensive lineman from 2002 to 2006 and a director of regional development for the university. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Tyler, Eric, happy to be here. I'm sure there are other people you could ponder with, but I'm happy to get the call today.
Let's start with the blue-gold game. What was your biggest takeaway? What did you see that you liked? What did you see that you were concerned? What if I just asked you what you saw, what was the biggest thing that you took away from it?
Yeah, you know, I thought the biggest thing I took away from it early was just really good operations offensively. When Steve was kind of running the show the first drive or two, like nothing really, you know, sexy or out there. They weren't trying to like gain viewers by any means, but it just seemed like operations went really well. And two things stuck out to me. First couple plays, obviously much more of a spread offense. It was nice to not have seven tight ends on the field. And obviously we didn't have a lot of receivers kind of available for the scrimmage, but you just start to see how Coach Denbrock can play with the numbers, and he's just got so many options, right? You know, to have multiple tight ends, but one split out. And I believe we threw like two or three passes to the running back, you know, in the first 10 or 15 plays, which is not something that we really did a lot last year. So yeah, I just think I saw what I needed to see early in the game. And that was just like, okay, the operations are smooth. We've got a different plan than we did last year. And then it was just fun to sit back and watch and specifically look for young guys. I wanted to see, you know, Kenny Minchie, you know, without the red jersey on, which I got to see. And, man, he's dynamic and fun to watch. And then, you know, sticking with the quarterbacks, watching C.J. Carr, who, lest we forget that he should be a senior in high school still right now, throwing with conviction and polish and looking good in and out of the pocket. Man, it's a fun quarterback room right now. And when you have excitement in that room, you've got excitement in all the rooms. And we can talk about some of those other rooms as well.
Well, when we have you on, I feel like you're the Dr. Phil of offensive line play in that we ask you to be a therapist for our listeners. And I'm curious. I'm sure that there are people that would expect the line to look like the 2015 line in November, but realistically, what was the best case scenario for a line that was split up on different sides and that might have five new starters?
Yeah, I will say this. I think the best case scenario is not giving up seven sacks over the course of the game, right? which is kind of what happened. You know, but I would also say, I think your best case scenario is you walk out of spring with a legitimate two deep and you're able to have those end of year conversations to say, this is what's out there for you. Right. You look at the tackle spots. And so, hey, Tosh, right now you're at the top of our top two at tackle. Emil Wagner, you're, you know, near the top of our top two at tackle. This is out there for both of you. And let's see how they go and change their body and get used to the system while they can individually at home. And then we've got, you know, kind of the final sprint of the race when it comes back to fall. But you've got people pushing for those individual battles. And then in the fall, you've really got to bring that unit together. Wasn't bothered by the pressures that came in or the lack of interior running game for some of the game. I kind of expected it. But, you know, this should be the last time that we see some of the inconsistencies that we saw throughout the game.
Let's focus on that right tackle battle. How do those guys get better over the summer without Joe Rudolph being there to help them? I mean, maybe they go to Harry's house and Niles or whatever, but you know, how do you individually get better? Is it film work? Is it in the weight room? Is it a combination of things? How would you go about advising them if they came to your house and said, we need to get better so I can beat out the other guy?
Yeah, so I think it really depends on kind of dissecting what their strengths and weaknesses are. You know, I've talked on this podcast about just kind of the, I think it was between second and third year that Ryan Harris went from a really, really good left tackle and came back with a 35, 40 pound swing in his bench press, had changed his body and ended up having just an unbelievable last 2 years, which kind of launched him into the NFL. So depending on what these guys need, right? Like, there's not going to be a boatload of change in Tosh Baker's, body size and composition compared to he's already been doing this for 4 years. But for him, is it a footwork thing? Is it a recognition thing? Is it a system thing? Whatever those issues are, like, you've got to spend the extra investment. So whether it's, getting an iPad and watching extra film, watching some LSU film and just Denbrock play calling film to work on that recognition, whether it's, really hyper-focusing on certain types of footwork so that your body can do what your brain is telling it to do. I think people, forget that some of the coordination of offensive line footwork is not intuitive to even the best of athletes. You've got to learn how to do that. And there's a little bit of dance choreography that goes in. You've got to do it over and over again. And then, for Emil more than for Tosh, there's continuing to fill out his body and make sure that it's ready for an entire season. And so whatever those individual, I'm going to call them pain points are, in addition to what the entire team is doing, where you're gaining and earning that respect with teammates, you've got to be working on your own to make sure that you're addressing some of the issues that you have in your game so that you don't have those issues come the fall.
Bob, moving over to the left side, and I think some of what I see in Charles Jagusa and maybe his deficiencies as a young player are a little bit similar to what Tosh Baker is. I think, in a perfect world, if Joe Alt's back, Charles Jagusa's challenging at the right tackle spot. You don't have to put him at left tackle. I think he is being put in a position that maybe is a little bit advanced for his skill set at this age. But how much struggles is it worth watching a guy go through with maybe some speed around the edge if he's a good mover in the run game? To me, that's what I see from Charles, as someone who's a very capable run blocker, but I think gets beat with speed around the edge sometimes. Is that something that you can be patient with and sort of allow to happen in the season?
Yeah, so I think that there's obviously weight on him to improve, right? So if he's getting, beat on the edge with speed, like, he's got to be working on some of those initial pass sets and footwork and using his outside hand to make sure that he's really pushing the edge wide. You don't need him to not get beat. You need him to get beat at 7 yards so the quarterback can move up to 5 yards, mm-hmm. right? So kind of it is what it is. You know what you do well, and you just make sure that what you don't do well fits within the play calling. With that, some of protecting your offense is protecting what you have up front with your play calling, right? And so if, we had my fifth year, we had a left tackle in Ryan Harris. We had a right tackle in Sam Young. Now, Sam Young was unbelievable, right? Like, maybe the best freshman that I played with on an offensive line, and I played with Ryan Harris. But that season, Ryan Harris could diagnose where he needed to be in one-on-one situations, and Sam needed to do a little less diagnosing. So we spent a lot of the time bringing our line to the right, to Sam's side. And all that does is it protects his inside, because Ryan could handle his inside and outside at once. And for that season, we wanted Sam to make sure he protected his outside gap, and then he had some help inside in case somebody came inside. So ultimately, you'd like to have a right tackle who can protect himself inside and outside, whether through experience like Tosh or athleticism like Emil, and you want to be able to bring your help, to the left side so that Charles can, again, he can be a little more aggressive on his set to take care of those speed guys, knowing that if the guy bolts inside, he's going to at least have the outside shoulder of the guard helping him, protect the quarterback, get him to 2.5, 3.5 seconds to get the ball downfield.
Bob, knowing that the teams were kind of split up where the tackles in the center were guys that had worked together and the guards were on a different unit from them. But all things considered, are there a couple of guys on the offensive line where you say, I see the corner turning with these guys? I feel pretty good about these one or two linemen at this point.
It's a little hard for me to not look at kind of as an entire unit, right? I think that We
know
saw
we're
last
making
year.
you speak a foreign language by singling linemen out individually. They're like,
listen.
I'm going to the bathroom. They all have to go together.
I think that a couple things. One, I said at the end of the year last year, I thought we kind of hit a revelation when Ashton came in at center. I'd really like to see him stay there and lock up that position. I think center is one of those positions that if you have someone that is really, really good at that, they are worth investing in multiple years over the course of time. When I was a fourth and fifth year guy, I was a center slash guard, right? So started at the first of those two seasons at center, started the second of those two seasons at guard. But the trust that Charlie Weiss put on John Sullivan and myself to really handle the protections so that Brady could handle kind of hot routes and everything going on outside of the line, I think allowed us to do things offensively that not a lot of teams could do then or have done since then. And then talking with a lot of offensive coordinators that I, kind of operate in the circle of now, a lot of those line calls are going to be made kind of from quarterbacks or from the sideline, not from your center and guard. So I think if you can invest in one person at center over the course of 2-3 seasons and have a chance to have that center handle the blocking scheme like they do at the NFL level, like I think that you've got yourself the ability to audible things at the line of scrimmage. I think the guards are going to be interesting. You've got so much talent. There are things I like about all of the guys that you have inside there, but it really is going to be not just about finding the five best, which I know is a Coach Rudolph thing, but you've got to figure out who's the best in coordination with your other bests, because you're going to have pairs of guys that have a natural fit for one another more so than others. And you've really got to find a way to have that unit be as strong as it can. And we don't want to have, a by committee approach, but there are going to be opportunities to rotate people in certain circumstances. And I think you've got a lot of talent in that room, and figuring out how to use everybody to your advantage is going to be key.
Bob, we saw Sam Pendleton at center 2 weekends in a row with the scrimmage that we were able to see as reporters, and then the Blue Gold game, have some issues with snapping. And he's going to be a sophomore. He's still a freshman. I think, is put in that position because they like where he's at. Like, they feel like he's advanced and he can handle the responsibilities of being a center, but the snapping thing isn't necessarily coming along as they'd like to. How much time is a fair amount of time to allow him to work through those struggles, and what is the key to making sure you sort of maybe get past that after you run into some issues?
Yeah, I think that when it comes to playing center, it's a unique position from the other linemen, because you're not just picking your hand up. You've got to do something with it. That being said, I don't think that there's anything that makes someone better or not from being able to do it. I do think anybody is able to snap a football before they do things. It's just a matter of understanding what's causing the snapping issue.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a mental block. It can be a physical kind of reaction. You're in that stress environment, kind of fight or flight, and you're so quick to fight that your hand is not moving exactly where you want it to. I would say if I had, a couple weeks to work with someone just on that, I would really try and map out, what mental cues can I give them that produces results? Hey, if you're going to move to the left, then you need to actually think that you're snapping it and almost like you're trying to hit yourself on your right cheek, because as you move left, your center moves right. And your body center of gravity moves right. And so you've got to change these mental pictures of where you're snapping from and try and map those things to then give them a sense of how to get the ball back where it is. I think you've seen a lot of other schools with athletes that are not as good as ours change the way centers are holding the ball. As much as my old head says, I just want people to hold the ball the way we always have. Like, if there's some way to change the physical product of what's happening, I think that you explore all options. And I don't think, you're in a rush until fall. I do think when you get to fall, you've got to figure out if your starting centers, got a hiccup for a play, for a quarter, for a game, for a season. You can't just have somebody that you're hoping can get the ball back, because your entire offense runs on that snap. you've got to make sure you have a number two who you can count on and be game ready.
So, Bob, when the offensive line doesn't look, or when it does look like people feel like it should, the offensive line coach gets a lot of feedback from the fan base. I'm curious, how easy or difficult is it to tell how good of an offensive line coach Joe Rudolph is? And I guess the piggybacking on that, how much does Mike Denbrock's presence on the team help this evolution with the offensive line?
Yeah, so I think that your offensive line coach gets an improper amount of blame when the offensive scheme does not fully account for, you know, blitzes or certain defenses. And when the play calling really puts your offensive line at a disadvantage. And so I think when you have an offensive coordinator that understands the offensive line, Coach Denbrock was a coach of mine on the offensive line. When you have someone that understands really the big picture of an offense and how to get the best out of the 11 people on the field, it then allows the proper amount of focus to come into all the other assistants. And is there a coach that's excelling or falling behind or, you know, exactly where we want them to be? I think that when you look at the offensive line that we're kind of putting together, it will be proper, I think, you know, kind of mid end of this season to really say, you know, how well is Coach Rudolph carving out kind of a legacy for himself here at Notre Dame, because the recruiting piece has been great. The talent has been unbelievable. I don't often meet a group of people and feel like a small person. And there's something about this offensive line that it's like, I don't even know. I could have been the water boy for these guys. You know what I mean?
Water boy, Bob.
happy to. But I do wonder, right? Like, how are we going to develop these guys to get them game ready, right? We didn't need to develop tackles last year. We had them. We need to develop interior. Well, I don't feel like we have an exclamation point on the inside quite yet. And now we have to develop the outside. And so there's a lot of development going on. And we're doing this at a point where we're not just trying to be a top 25 or a top 20. We're trying to be firmly in the top 12 and make a run at a national championship. And so we need to operate at a national championship level on the front of our offense. And so will we be able to put those pieces together is going to be the big question. And I think having Mike Denbrock there, who I can tell you from experience and from conversations, like his play calling is going to take into account what this offensive line does well, doesn't do well. And he's going to take risks based on those things, which means that we need to make sure our offensive line is ready to do what Mike Denbrock is essentially calling them to do.
Bob, you've seen plenty of young quarterbacks through your days. What can you put some context to how good you think CJ Carr looks for an early enrolled freshman? I think, from my perspective, if you just watched him and didn't know he was a freshman, I don't think you would have any idea that he was a freshman by the way he looked on Saturday.
Yeah. So, you know, my experience kind of evaluating quarterbacks is so vast. It's not really, I don't really have a whole lot of experience talking about quarterbacks, but I'll say this. I got to see Carlisle Holiday this past weekend. We had, you know, Coach Freeman brought back any former football player who wanted to, and Carlisle was in town from the Bay Area where he and his family live. And I remember my redshirt freshman year, so my first year starting, Carlisle was our starting quarterback, and just did some things, man, that were unbelievable. Like, one of the best athletes we had on the team, threw a really nice ball. There was a little bit of accuracy issues, but we had an offense that we thought could really use those skills effectively. And Brady Quinn shows up in the fall and was really, really raw. You know, obviously not as much of a runaround athlete as Carlisle was, but there was something when Brady threw the ball that was just like, ooh, I have not seen that before, right? There was just almost like an audible zip to the ball when it left his hand and it went to a receiver. And it just made you sit back and say, I don't know if it's going to be week three, year three, or whatever it is, but this kid's got some game time in him at quarterback. The feeling that I had watching Brady Quinn come to campus is the feeling that I've had watching CJ Carr play when I've seen him play. I think one of his first passes that was incomplete, he stood in the pocket, delivered a ball that was intuitive. He threw it with conviction. He threw it in a good spot. And if it wasn't for another freshman, the middle linebacker KVA making a great play on it, it just like, it's like, oh cow, like that's a ball that we're going to put some points on the board with eventually. Seeing him get out of the pocket and not look scared for his life, but, you know, find passes downfield with that, that's an element that we have not had consistently at quarterback, and it's a modern football element. I'm really excited. I don't know if it's, you know, for, for a game, a year, a 4-year career. I have my hopes, but this is a guy that can change the game for what our ceiling is long-term at Notre Dame. And he comes as advertised, if not a little bit more polished and refined. And so if he's as much the film head as I've heard he is, if he's as much the learner of the game as he seems to be, and we're able to, you know, kind of keep his jersey pretty clean as an offensive line, it's going to be a really fun time when the CJ Carr window opens. And we've got some individuals he can learn behind before that window does crack open.
Yeah, that window is going to be exciting, and I do think it'll be 2025. I think he's positioning himself to make a run then. As far as 2024, Riley Leonard gets added back into the equation this summer, and then the first couple weeks of training camp, we're going to see who the number one quarterback is. What are your hopes for Riley Leonard? What do you think's realistic in terms of what you know of him, if he can turn into this NFL-type prospect guy versus a guy with just a whole bunch of really interesting tools?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that I'll say, I'm disappointed. I'm not disappointed in a person. I am truly like, oh, man, what, it was a missed opportunity. We all talk about the knowledge that it's kind of Riley Leonard's job to lose, like, but, you know, it's him, Steve Angeli, kind of vying for that starting spot. When you have a transfer come in trying to kind of assert himself as the number one and you have spring ball, you really want that. You kind of want that question answered leaving spring ball, right? And what stinks is Riley has done everything you could ask of him in the community and around the school and, you know, kind of being just a person who's enjoyed and valued on the team already. I loved seeing him, you know, on the field, you know, kind of behind the play and just, you know, how he operated. You would have loved to have left 15 practices in the spring game with him being the number one guy because he's done everything else right. Instead, you have Steve Angeli, who has done everything you've asked of him going back a couple years now, right? In every sample size he's had, you know, whatever you can measure success as for him, he's done it. And now no matter what each of them do in the summer, short of transferring, they're going to end up in the fall having to have this competition that you would have loved to have had the last 15 practices. In terms of what I think Riley Leonard can bring to this team, I've said, and this is just my take, it's not in talking to other people, I believe that the window for a Notre Dame national championship truly opens when CJ Carr starts the season at quarterback. However, that being said, when we retained 90% of our defense, when we, you know, put together the best pairing of coordinators that Notre Dame has put together in quite some time, when we got an athletic dual threat quarterback, the likes of which Mike Denbrock has had a lot of success, all of a sudden you kind of crack the window to, holy cow, if everything comes together, you know, we've got a chance to have an offense that with Steve Angeli or Riley Leonard can win 9, 10, 11 games. But with a dual threat guy like Riley Leonard can make just enough plays downfield to maybe put us over the top against the top 2-3 teams in the country this year. And so that's the perfect storm. If he's healthy, can do what he needs to in the pocket, can play to a really high floor, and then in those moments, you know, kind of do that extra dual threat stuff, that dual threat stuff gives us those 25-yard passes over the linebackers that helps us take down the elite teams that are going to be in the mix, getting a first-round bye, come playoff time.
Bob, you mentioned that there were plenty of former football players on campus last weekend for the Blue Gold game. That also coincided with the announcement of Shields Family Hall, the new football facility that will be built by fall of 2026. What are your thoughts on the investment that's being made in the program there and how cool it is to see so many former football players sort of be a part of making that possible?
Yeah, I mean, this is the perfect intersection for me between what I did at Notre Dame and what I do now, right? So football and development. Three of the four major donors to build Shields Hall, including the individual whose name goes in the front of it, are former football players. The majority of people in kind of the forgotten generation that I played in that haven't really been invited back until Marcus Freeman came around. Like, we existed in the shift between, working out in Loftus and our locker room being in the stadium every day to the Guglielmino Center. And so being able to see what the next iteration of that's going to be makes me really proud. I have a couple unique relationships in terms of, people who are kind of in the planning of this. I'm really excited that we didn't build a new facility 10 years ago when we were just throwing a bunch of technology in every locker room and trying to, impress all the 17 and 18 year old recruits. But we're in a place where we're looking for really functional, high performance, facilities that will benefit our football players in a major, major way. And let's go ahead and say the non-football kind of Olympic sports that will backfill some of the space that, the football team won't be using anymore. It gets really exciting what this means for Notre Dame athletics as a whole. And so Jack has said it, right? Like, as football flies, so too the athletics programs fly at Notre Dame. We need a football national championship. And I do feel like the other athletes, the other coaches, the other programs, they recognize just kind of the global benefit they have at Notre Dame when football, gets something new. Everybody kind of gets something new in a way as well. And so, yeah, it's a really exciting time to see what the future could be for all of these kind of performance and training and, the nutrition, all of these things kind of existing in one house.
So Bob is in New York today and he's getting ready to catch an Uber. So I'll make this my last question so that he can get his tip money ready and his mouthwash and all that stuff. The NFL draft is this weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Notre Dame is projected to have 8 players drafted. I'm wondering, first of all, what you think Joe Alt's future in the NFL will be. And is there one of those 8 where you think they're going to be a way better or at least a little bit better NFL prospect than where they get drafted?
Yeah. I'm going to try and keep my response short, because when you bring up Joe Alt, there's a story that I need to tell about offensive linemen. But let me just say, I believe historically we will be talking about 2 names for a long time in terms of the greatest offensive linemen to come out of Notre Dame, and that's Joe Alt and Quentin Nelson. And I think they're different players in a lot of ways, but they're very similar in a lot of ways. The work ethic, the humility, the attitude that they bring, the consistency with which they play. I think, you could draft him at number 1, and I still feel like he's underrated in terms of what he'll be able to do for a team and program should he continue to stay injury free. I had a really amazing opportunity. Quentin came back for this Legacy Network thing and just happened to be shaking his hand and just thanking him for the brand of football he plays, tell him it's fun to watch him. And we both got pulled over to a table where Coach Holtz was sitting. And, I have a lot of experiences with Coach Holtz. We went to Japan together for the Notre Dame Japan Legends game. But when Quentin Nelson's at a table, Coach Holtz doesn't want to talk to Bob Morton, and I'm really okay with that. I have a picture of these 2 guys just, talking shop and talking football. And Coach Holtz was asking questions like, well, why didn't you win last year? Why didn't you make the playoffs? Well, why didn't you do this when your quarterback got hurt? Why didn't your quarterback have success in college? Like, all of these things. And part of me is like, I want to be like, Coach Holtz, like, do you know who this is? Like, this is the best offensive lineman to come out of Notre Dame. But I was just in awe sitting and listening to Quentin talk about himself and his career in the most humble of terms. And I was talking to Hunter Biven about that conversation. I mean, literally almost tears in my eyes, just so impressed by this person that came from my alma mater. And Hunter said, Joe's cut from the same cloth. And I what I love about Notre Dame is I feel like whether it's, you know, a finance major, somebody in arts and letters, an engineer, or a football player, we can be proud of the young men and women that come out of Notre Dame. And what I love is some of the most famous people are going to be the ones that are drafted, you know, in the coming days. And they're going to go into new cities and they're going to kind of shine the light of their character into those cities. And we can be really proud of everything they're going to do. The second part of your question, I'm buying an Andre Gasame jersey no matter what team he plays for. You know what I mean? Like, I understand that running backs are somewhat devalued in today's NFL and quarterbacks are hypervalued. But when you look at someone who can do it all in terms of a running back, right? He can block really effectively. He can run like a train, but he can also outrun some folks. He's got a little bit of that Derrick Henry. Like, you're worried he's going to run you over, but then he could just run past you too. I think that if he gets in the right offense that doesn't mind having a bell cow, that doesn't want to go by committee for the entire year, I think you'd be looking at a year one, year two, where he's putting up some pretty crazy numbers. And so I think if you get the right offense who needs a running back, you know, maybe in the Lone Star State, I think that it could be a really special combination of him at running back for whatever team that is.
Well, all right, Bob, that's all we got for you. We really appreciate you taking time to talk to us as always and your insights, and hopefully things are going well for you.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you guys so much for giving me the opportunity to talk shop a little bit.
Before we get to our question segment, I wanted to remind our listeners of our subscription promo for InsideNDSports.com. We continue to offer a 30-day free trial to our podcast listeners who want to try out a subscription to the site. That will get you access to all of our premium content, the Insider Lounge message board, and you don't have to wait for the next podcast to ask us a question. You can take advantage of this offer by using promo code NDPOD. That's NDPOD when you sign up for a subscription on InsideNDSports.com. You can also find a link to the deal in the podcast description or show notes. All right, now it's time for questions. You can submit your questions to us on Twitter or the Insider Lounge message board before every podcast. I'm at TJamesND and Eric's at EHansenND. First one I have for us, Eric, is from SJB75 on the Insider Lounge. 3 days removed from the spring game, which position group gives you the most concern staring at a game one at Texas A&M?
My top three are offensive line, and offensive line. I don't think there's anything that's close with that.
Yeah.
And we just spent quite a bit of the podcast talking about both the concerns and possible upside on that, but offensive line is my answer.
Yeah, I agree. I think the pass protection is suspect at this point. I think even with the guys that we have questions about, I think the run blocking is pretty solid, but pass protection is where I have the biggest concern if we narrow that down even more beyond offensive line. All right, next question is from LDO Go Irish on the Insider Lounge. We have a few, as you can imagine, we have a few offensive line related questions. LDL says, Tyler and Eric, I watched the O-line pretty close during the game. I'm not a member of the press, but I did have the ability to see the scrimmage the week before. Oh, did not have the ability, sorry. Based upon the blue-gold game, only I felt that Rocco Spindler was easily the top O-line player for the game. Spindler was followed by Craig, a tie between Shrouth and Pat Coogan, Absher and Wagner next, with Jagusa and Baker tied for the worst performance. What did you and Eric see? What have you heard? I have great hope for improvement with every lineman before opening day, especially the starting tackles.
So I was doing radio color commentary, so I had to watch the ball a little bit more than I would have had I been sitting next to Tyler. And I don't doubt your observations in the context that you presented it. I think overall it's been a better spring for the interior guys than the tackles. I still think Emil Wagner will overtake Tosh Baker unless Notre Dame gets a portal tackle, then that person will overtake both of them. I think Rocco has a fighting chance to overtake Coogan. And I still think the evaluations that matter the most as a unit are the ones that we'll be talking about in the later part of August.
Yeah, to do a similar sort of ranking that LDL did, I want to spend more time rewatching the game. I haven't had a chance to rewatch the full blue gold game yet. As we record this on Tuesday morning, I've just been working on a lot of recruiting stuff, but I think Jagusa and Baker struggled the most of the tackles in pass pro. I thought the interior was pretty good at the top. Overall, Ashton Craig and Billy Stroud are the two offensive linemen I feel the best about. I think the blue goal game was maybe the best we've seen from Rocco Spindler this spring. So that it seems to indicate he's sort of rounding into shape and getting back to full health. So that sort of heats up the competition. I sort of indicated when we saw him early in the spring moving over to left guard, I was like, this is probably meaning that the Rocco Spindler, Pat Coogan competition is going to start heating up, and Billy Stroud has maybe won that right guard spot. And that's the way I feel about it. I haven't had a chance to ask Joe Rudolph about that specifically since then, but that's what it seems to be right now. So I think those guys will continue to battle. There was nothing necessarily from Saturday's game that stuck out about Pat Coogan's performance. I was able to rewatch the first quarter. I was doing that before we hit record today. And Jason Anie did beat Pat Coogan on the first third down of the game. I think that's just a tough matchup right now for most anyone, because Jason Anie is really ascending. I don't have any strong takeaways from Sullivan Apsher and Emil Wagner. I think they were fine, but not spectacular. It was sort of be how I would describe them. But I'm looking forward to sort of diving deeper into what they did, because especially on one watch, some of the bad things stick out, but you don't necessarily get a good sense for the good things they did. So I think to have like a full scope of that, I need to rewatch the game and try to see as much as I can from everyone out there.
And candor, I was rewatching The Voice from last night before we went on the air, because my DVR did not record it and it was a crisis.
But you found a way
watching it online on NBC.com.
You found a way to solve that. All right. Another O-line question. Bob_Oxnard on the Insider Lounge said, based strictly on what you saw in the open scrimmage and blue gold game, rank these players in order of who gave up the fewest pressures / sacks, fewest to most.
So I didn't isolate on those guys enough to make this accurate. I would have to rewatch like Tyler did.
Oh, hold on. I never said the names. The names are the four tackles: Sullivan Apsher, Tosh Baker, Charles Jagusa, and Emil Wagner.
Okay. And they weren't always going against the same edge players. So
right.
In terms of who I'd have the most confidence in when we get to August 31st, not on August 1st, I'll go with this order: Jagusa, Wagner, Baker, and Apsher. And that's when it's going to matter. Now, I did an awful analogy on this, so I'm going to try to make a better one today. I did on Football Never Sleeps. It sounded awful. So this is my analogy. It's like opening up the oven and sampling a cake halfway through the baking cycle. That is much better than what I said on Football.
And we will not repeat what you said on Football Never Sleeps.
You have to go watch it yourself and throw tomatoes at the screen.
Like I said, I don't have all that charted. The hard part about the scrimmage is that we don't have any replay opportunities. So like what you saw when you saw it is what you saw and whatever you wrote down. So I can go back and look at some of the pressures that I charted in terms of guys that gave up stuff. It would not be as comprehensive as a rewatch. So I'm giving myself homework for Bob Oxnard that I'll get back to him on the Insider Lounge with maybe some numbers to support this question. So I don't really have a great answer yet for them. I did want to point out as you sit and watch it, Apsher and Wagner were going primarily against Jordan Botello, Joshua Burnham, Junior Tuihalamaka, and Grant Ristoff, a walk-on, and then Charles Jagusa and Tosh Baker were going against R.J. Oben, Boubacar Traore, Bryce Young, and then Kobe Onyeka, another walk-on. So I don't know how you would power rank those. Obviously, Botello has a lot of experience. I think in terms of pass rushing, that the guys that Jagusaw and Tosh Baker go against, I think it may be a bit more formidable. So maybe that plays into the thoughts that we have from the Blue Gold game, but certainly there's room for improvement there. I mean, that's what we've been talking about all spring. So I think there's still a ways to go to feeling really confident about that group. Mr. Joe Seiler asks, if the O-line can work with Harry Hiestand in the offseason, is there any chance they will?
I think those who have relationships with him will pick his brain, and he's local, so he's available and willing to be a resource.
Right. Yeah, I think, yeah, it would be individually, not like as a group. I don't know that it would happen in sort of like having 10 offensive linemen go to a field with Harry Hiestand. I think if that were to happen, I think Harry Hiestand would certainly need and want the blessing of Joe Rudolph to do that so as not to be seen as sort of meddling in what Joe Rudolph is trying to do. All right. Next question is from Marie Biafore at Biafore underscore Marie. Based on what you saw during the spring game, who do you think will be the starting right tackle in the fall, and who do you think will start between Pat Coogan and Rocco Spindler? Who do you think the top six wide receivers are, and do you think we should expect transfers out of that room?
Well, I sure recommend that Tyler be nice to Marie today, based on an email I got. And I know Marie was just kidding about making Tyler go get a happy meal at McDonald's when Marie and I went out to dinner to Atlanta without him. So I've mentioned that I think Wagner's going to win that job if Notre Dame doesn't go to the portal. And I do think Spindler has a good chance to win the job. As far as the receivers, there are 11 of them, and Mike Brown has said the deepest he thinks the rotation would go is six or seven. So the math would suggest there could be a stress point there in terms of roster attrition. My top six in order would be great at this moment: Great House, Jaden Thomas, Jordan Faison, Chris Mitchell. I'm going to give Bo Collins the benefit of the doubt and put him in the top six, and Micah Gilbert. And I think very close in the conversation would be KK Smith, Deon Colsey, and Cam Williams really came on toward the end of spring. We didn't get to see him in the Blue Gold game because I think it was a hamstring pull, but we did see him in the scrimmage the week before, and he looked pretty good. I'd say kind of the back burner guys would be Jaden Harrison, who really came in more as a return guy, and Logan Saldate, who is a freshman, who's at the stacked slot receiver position as well, and who I think you can bring him along a little bit more slowly.
Yeah, going with the receivers first, I had Great House, Chris Mitchell, Jaden Thomas, Jordan Faison, Bo Collins, and Jaden Harrison sort of deferring to experience there. I would not be surprised if Micah Gilbert replaced one of Collins or Harrison in some sort of combination. I think a lot of it depends on health. Like, can Jaden Thomas stay healthy? Because if he can't, then he's probably not sticking in this top six for long. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a transfer out. I think more than one transfer, I think, would be a little bit surprising. But I wouldn't rule out their Notre Dame losing someone in the receiver group in the next 7 days. But in terms of the offensive line, based on the spring game, I don't think Tosh Baker will be the right tackle. Whether that's Emil Wagner or a transfer coming in, I don't know. And then I mean, if you get a transfer that would be a left tackle, then I think Charles Jagusaw could certainly be the right tackle. So still to be TBD in terms of what I think will happen at the tackle position. And based on the spring game, I think Spindler probably played better than Pat Coogan, so he would be the starting left guard. But there's certainly much more than the spring game that will be part of the evaluation, and I don't want to like put too much weight on just the one spring scrimmage. Obviously they have plenty of time to improve. And we saw last year, like what leaves spring as the assumed starting offensive line does not have to be the assumed starting offensive line going into preseason camp, because they're Joe Rudolph has shown the willingness to change that up and find new guys that he wants to push forward. Next question is from at Mike Devoy One. I think our first one without any offensive line question. The boundary receiver position looks to be stacked with talent based on the results of the Blue Gold game. If Bo Collins is number four in that group, do you think he might transfer if none of the three receivers in the group go into the portal?
I don't think he's going to be number four, and he's really not going to be able to prove where he stands until August. I mean, this is a guy that was not on a very good passing attack because of some quarterback and offensive coordinator and offensive line issues, and still had better numbers than anybody on Notre Dame's team last year. So I would be really surprised if Bo Collins both was number four or transferred.
Yeah, and he's certainly not going to believe he's fourth, right, without practicing. It's not like he was out there this spring and all those guys were better than him. I think he's going to feel like he can come in and be the starter, potentially. I think that's what his hope is. He's been a starter at Clemson, and for as much improvement as we've seen there, it's not like Notre Dame's receivers are world beaters, right? Like, I don't know that if you look at the boundary group, there's no one in that group that's probably – for sure getting drafted next year. So, like, I think that's Bo Collins' goal, is to play at Notre Dame and get drafted. So I don't think that he's going to have that attitude about where he stands in the pecking order that Mike DeVoy is suggesting here. Next question is from at Mike DeVoy one again. When talking about the 2024 sack leaders, you didn't mention RJ Oben. After his performance in the blue gold game, don't you think he has a strong shot to lead the team in sacks?
I think there are a lot of players who are in that discussion, and I think he's one. He was quiet, just like Javonte Jean-Baptiste was
right
for most of the spring. And then until the last two times I saw him, I saw something different. I'm still going to go with Boubacar Traore, but because of all the rotations in the front seven and the different ways ND can bring pressure, I think the sacks are going to be pretty spread out.
Yeah, that was the best that I've seen RJ Oben look this spring, which is why I didn't necessarily mention him the last time we discussed this. I'm not sure how his new responsibilities will impact him as a pass rusher in the season. I think there's no doubt that he has the ability to get after the quarterback. I certainly wouldn't be shocked if he ended up leading Notre Dame in sacks, and maybe because he is becoming more well-rounded, he's just always on the field in pass rush situations, so that would give him the opportunity to do that. Whereas maybe, like, when you talk about Jordan Botello and Boubacar Traore and some of those other guys, maybe there's mixing and matching, and so they're not always out there as much, and maybe RJ Oben's the constant there. So I think it's probably a bad job by me if I didn't mention him at all, but I think it probably, based on the lack of him flashing in spring, but certainly we've seen him rush the passer very well in his career at Duke, and he did some good things in the blue gold game as well. All right, last question we have is from at Charles W. Wolf. After bowl practices, spring, and the blue gold game, where is CJ Carr's development compared to where you thought he might be?
It's ahead of where I thought he might be, and I had reasonably high expectations. I think one thing that helped CJ was Riley Leonard's injury. I think it gave him more actual reps than mental reps.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that made me think that he would develop well was just his maturity and mentality. I had a chance to do a one-on-one interview with him when he was still in high school, and he was just so impressive and had such good life perspective and such a reasonable view of what being a freshman at Notre Dame would be like. And then we talked to him again, kind of coming in the door, and again, really impressive young man in terms of setting his goals and having a good perspective and not getting too far over his skis, as we like to say. So yeah, that's how I look at CJ Carr.
Yeah. I think he has to be, I don't think it would be reasonable to see what he's done and say he's on track with what I thought he would be. I think he's been that good that it's like, how could you anticipate him to be as good as he's been? And I think my perspective is, especially some of the stuff he was doing in the scrimmage the week before that we saw, it's a lot harder to make like some of the receivers that he's playing with look good than I think we maybe give credit for, that you would think. Like, some of those guys, you've never heard their names before, and you probably won't hear their names much again. And he was making plays with them, and that's not easy. And so I think He's ahead of where I would have projected him. I think the longer I've done this, the more I just sort of like lower expectations for quarterbacks, and then like want to see them come in and do things. Because when Brandon Wimbush got here, when Tyler Buchner got here, when Phil Dracovic got here, all guys that I thought were very good high school players, you see them in practice as a freshman, you're like, okay, it's going to take some time. Like they're not ready yet. Whereas CJ Carr, it's like, man, what is he not doing right now that you would want him to do? And I don't know that the list is very long there. So I think he looks great. I think the future is very bright for him. I'm not getting ahead. I think some people, when we compliment CJ Carr, are like, well, then why doesn't he the starter? It's like, well, he's still a freshman. We're talking about based on where he is as a freshman, not like based on where he could be as someone that could lead Notre Dame to the playoff. So I think there's still plenty of time for CJ Carr to cook in that oven that Eric likes to talk about, and then they could take him out later when he's ready to go. But I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic about CJ Carr's future at Notre Dame.
And I can even go back and think about what Brady Quinn was like as a freshman and Jimmy Clausen was as an early enrollee. Now, Jimmy had an elbow issue, and his dad was shadowing him everywhere. His dad wanted to be in the quarterback meetings, and Charlie wouldn't let him. And CJ Carr is better at this stage than those guys were, and we'll see if that continues.
All right, that is it for today's episode of the Inside Indy Sports Podcast. If you don't already, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other popular podcast platforms. If you like what you hear, give us a star rating, leave a review, and share our podcast feed with the best offensive tackle you know. As I mentioned earlier, we're offering a 30-day free trial to our podcast listeners who want to try out a subscription to InsideIndySports.com. So please take advantage of that with code NDPOD. That's NDPOD. We'll continue to stay in weekly mode here with the podcast, and we'll try to keep Football Never Sleeps on Mondays as well. So we'll have plenty of recruiting, transfer portal, and NFL draft content coming your way. So stick with InsideIndySports.com for all your Notre Dame coverage needs.